Bobby. I'm an alcoholic.
Bobby.
Thanks for having me here tonight. It's always a privilege. Welcome to everybody who's new. I saw that we have a couple of familiar, or new faces, excuse me. So that's exciting, coming into AA. I remember that feeling of coming here and thinking, oh my God, what a bunch of losers. Do not want to be here. My drinking was pretty short and sweet, to the point. I drank from the age of 14 to 20. And for those of you who say, well, how could you possibly be an alcoholic? Well, you just leave me alone at your house for a few days and see what that looks like. And when the authorities contact you about finding your vehicle in another state, and there's been some sort of fraudulent activity on your bank account, and another significant loved one I'm somehow entangled with, just looks like a regular weekend for me, you know? Again, thank you. Welcome. When I first came to AA, I did not think I was an alcoholic. It's apparently a very important thing here to realize that you are an alcoholic. That identification piece was huge. I'll give you a little bit of background. Myself, my father is an alcoholic. He is not in sobriety. He uses other mind-altering things. Mainly he smokes weed, and I would much prefer him if he just smoked weed, honestly. Because when he gets drunk, man, he's nasty. He was a violent man. I never saw him violent. He grew up that way. His father was a very violent man. I have heard stories about a different refrigerator or freezer that had a chain and a lock on it, and that had the meat in the cooler or the fridge, and that was from my grandfather. He would come home on Friday after he got paid, and they would literally, my grandmother would get them all in the car and go sleep in the parking lot of the church in the car, because they didn't know what was going to happen with him. Before I was born, my dad's brother, my Uncle Jimmy, was 16 years old, and he got into it with my grandfather. And they got into this argument, and apparently he was drunk. My uncle was drunk, and my grandmother pleaded with him, don't get in the car, don't get in the car. He was 16, and he drove and hit a cul-de-sac and died. So I never met him. I have an aunt that was murdered by her husband in 1999. He killed himself. I've had an uncle who has had HIV through intravenous drug use, and that was in the 90s. He died of that. I've had countless other people that I don't even know most of my family. I joke, because don't take offense to this. I can make fun of myself because it's my ethnic background, but I'm Spanish and Italian. We all know we're going to roll deep, okay? So that's on both sides. So my dad's the Colombian-Mexican side and grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, okay? And if you just put some context in that, the KKK Grand Wizard in 1994 ran for governor and almost won. Very interesting climate down there, you would say. So on my mother's side, she has been diagnosed with bipolar. Her father was bipolar. He was a womanizer. He sexually abused other people in my family that I had absolutely no idea about until, you know, just a few years ago. And when he was found out about something that had occurred, he tried to kill himself. He put the car in the garage, and I guess he was going to take a little CO2 dirt nap, and that didn't work out. They found him, and he was paralyzed for the rest of his life. I never saw him walk, I never knew what was going on there. But needless to say, there is schizophrenia on both sides of my family. When I say drug and alcohol abuse on both sides, that's just, I couldn't even paint you a picture. My old joke used to be, our family can't get together for family get-together, family reunions. No one's on parole and probation at the same time. So, you know, all that stuff, you know, I grew up and I was very intelligent. I didn't know that at the time. I was just a kid who did well in school. Always kind of knew we didn't have money. I don't know why that was, but we didn't. And I remember my dad lost his job when I was very young. And I say that because there's something that always stuck out in my mind. From a very young age, I knew that we were broke as hell. And that was always like this thing that went on in my mom. You know, she's a very anxious person. And my dad lost his job. He's with this energy company. He's worked in plants for his entire life. And they got bought out. They let go people that had been there over 20 years. My aunt that I previously mentioned, she did very well for herself. She went into business. She was like business person of the year in Pascagoula, Mississippi in 1998, something like that. And she was a millionaire. I had no idea, but long story short, she had a house that she wasn't using because she had built herself a nice house. Now, when I was younger, I was like, man, that's so nice of her. We get to go move next to her. I was like, no, stupid, you're broke. You'd be out in the street if your aunt wasn't there. And, I was just oblivious to that. That's all great. You know, I grew up just watching my mom and dad and people in my family drink. I remember at one point we moved back to the Baton Rouge area. I live in lived around Denham Springs, Louisiana, home of the double wide. We like to say, what do a tornado and a divorce have in common? Livingston Parish, someone leaves them a double wide. So we lived in places I didn't particularly like. They were usually very small, and we were always without, and I didn't get to do things that other kids like to do, and I just kind of grew up with that in the back of my head. It wasn't really that apparent to me until my parents really were like, you can't have that crap. So I got into school, middle school, things were going okay. I was always socially awkward. Believe this or not, for those of you who have known me for a while, I was really quiet and I was very shy. And I was kind of a nerd. I really was. I didn't stand up for myself. I had low self-esteem. I hear people say that today and I'm like, okay, I get it now. You know, I just didn't fit in. I just didn't fit in and I didn't know what that was about. So my dad's dad died, and I'll summarize the relationship I had with him. When he had his third stroke from drinking and smoking, and they told him, stop drinking and smoking, you're going to have another stroke. Before he had that third stroke, he was a pain in the ass. He really was. He was not a nice person. And I knew him after he was violent. And I don't have any good memories of him. But after he had that last stroke, he couldn't talk. He lost his ability to speak. So at least he was quiet, you know what I mean? And he would write down little things on his little piece of paper when he needed to communicate with me. And I thought, man, this is a win. So when he died, and I had no relationship with that man, nor did my father, that was the first time I was like, what is going on with my family? Because my dad cried. I've seen him cry 3 times, and that was the first one. And I was very confused. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what alcoholism looks like. People around you are just torn up. They're confused. They're angry. They have all sorts of prejudice and unfinished business due to this illness, because it really just affected people around me. In that case, again, I was confused why I was supposed to be sad. I had absolutely no relationship with that man. Not many people did. So I went to school. I got into 9th grade, and then this huge thing happens. My aunt was murdered, and I remember getting that phone call. I didn't get it, but I remember the phone ringing, and I heard a scream that I've never heard again in my life, and it was my mom. And my dad had to go identify the bodies. And my uncle walked in the house, told my cousin to go tell his mom he wanted the sandwich. She came out, and they started an argument, and she went out in the middle of the street, and she followed him with a shotgun. And there was no premeditated note or anything like that. And, I mean, it just was one of those things. What can you say? There's nothing that anyone could ever say or do to make me feel, or anyone feel around my family, you know, any better about that. I lack the tools. I will tell you that one thing that I started to grow into, is we don't talk about what's actually going on. We don't talk about feelings. We ignore everything. If there's this big thing in the living room, like an elephant, we're just going to walk around that thing and we're not going to talk about anything. And my dad lost it. I mean, he was already an alcoholic, but I mean, he just went off the deep end at that point. My mom was really angry for a long time, and she actually has gotten like literal help. When I say she got help, she got literal help. She went to anger management. She got into therapy. She got into medication. She goes to church now. So when I say help, I mean she did some digging. She was a very sick person. I did not particularly like her for a long time, and nor did she particularly like me. The feeling that was quite mutual. They fought, and they fought a lot. And she would be so upset and so angry, and then she'd hit these highs and these lows. And I know today that's just as bipolar. But my dad was absent for a lot, and I was really mad. I became very angry at God, without even really saying, you know, I'm angry at God. But in my mind, it was like this world does not make sense to me. I don't fit in. I hate my family. They're all crazy. I don't know what's going on with them. I don't have anyone I can talk to. There's not a safe place or a person that I can confide in. Like, I don't know what's going on here. And I very soon after that feeling, and after my aunt was murdered, I took my first drink. I took my first drink, and it was great. I hear people say I got sick as a dog. Not me. I punched some guy in the head and broke my hand, and I was on pain pills. I'd never been on anything like that. And at that time, I was just like, oh, just take them as they're prescribed. Like, what idiot does that, you know? And so my dad had this, had some vodka, and I had some of my friends over, and we decided, you know, we're going to sneak some of that and put it in our Powerade, you know? And, you know, we're real classy guys, you know, get some Powerade, throw a few shots in there. So we have this Powerade, we go over to my other friend's house, and she's there with this other very attractive girl that I particularly like, and we play strip poker, and I won. And you fill in the blanks, you know, and I thought, holy, this is fantastic. And drinking is like magical, and my drinking never looked like that again, I can guarantee you. I don't think I ever won another game of strip poker. That's not what happened. It got weird. That's what happened. I was a progressive drinker, and by progressive meaning that I would drink one night on the weekends, but I could hold my liquor, and I could hold my liquor from the start. I didn't drink beer for first, like, you know, from 14, 15 to 16. Maybe I started drinking beer. I wanted liquor. Drugs are a part of my story. I'm not a drug addict. I don't identify as a drug addict. They're just a huge part. They were convenient, and I figured, you know, when I was drunk and I needed to sober up, yeah, cocaine is good. You know, it's just 1 + 1 = 2. You know, it wasn't like, gosh darn it, I just need to have that cocaine. It was just like, I want to get drunk. And I want to get drunk as possible. And when I get drunk as possible, I just do all sorts of things. I'm not even going to tell you I was a cocaine addict. I just wanted more. I just wanted more. And I had that kind of pattern very early on. And I was a binge drinker, like I was saying. I would go out Friday, and I mean, I'd get tanked, and people would tell me I was doing stupid stuff. And, you know, Friday, Saturday, you know, I'd recuperate, you know, and Sunday comes along, and, you know, you could have a couple, you know, you don't have to get drunk, but, I mean, it just kind of blurred very quickly to me, like that drinking, that progression went from Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I had friends. I'm from the South, I'm from Louisiana. We have drugs everywhere. I don't know if you guys know that. I mean, they talk about this stuff called Texas tea. It's liquid codeine and Sprite. I mean, that was just available all the time. You know, we had drive-through daiquiri shops. They sold Everclear at 7-Eleven. There wasn't like a lack of things that I could get into. But other people were not doing what I was doing. And what began to happen to my life is that drink took another, became something that it wasn't for other people. And it very quickly became something I very much looked forward to. And I don't remember that happening. I was trying to just be a normal kid in high school with, you know, a bunch of crazy parents and family members. And the next thing you know, I just start doing some very weird things. Start trying those other drugs. And you know what I figured out? I'm not good in math. but I'm a hell of an entrepreneur. And if you get one big block of something and then you divide that block into smaller blocks, you can make money doing that. And I did that a lot when I was in school. I didn't go to school to learn. I went to school to get away from my mom, because if she found me home, she'd just nag me and ruin my drunk or my high anyway. That was it. That was school for me. I started hanging out with people that were just very questionable. I started doing things that were very questionable. You people might have heard of New Orleans, you know. Oh man, I've got to go there to play. I got to tell you, you want to stay in the French Quarter. That's all you want to do, because everything outside of that is not nice and it is very dangerous. And I like to go out into those places to do dangerous things with dangerous people. And it was not like a conscious decision of like, hey, today I'm going to go to this guy where he's got a garage full of weed and there's, you know, a couple guys standing around. I think one of them's, or two of them, maybe all of them have a firearm, and you know, they're going to dump this 5-gallon bucket of weed and they're going to weigh out this stuff here. And that's what I, you know, yeah, that sounds like good for a Friday. Yeah, I'm going to do that. Very, very quickly, the sanity part of my life, what was normal once, very quickly changed, and I adapt. And I think this has a lot to do, for me, in my opinion, is my spiritual malady. I am trying to find something that gives me meaning and purpose in my life, and I don't know it. And I didn't know it for a long time, even in AA. You know, I was here to get sober, and I didn't realize what you guys really had to offer. But as you might guess, I wasn't exactly on the dean's list at school. My dad really didn't stay around that much, and at this point, I mean, I'm just drinking and drugging every day. Some people say every day, and I say yes, every day. I couldn't get my hands on everything every day, but I was doing something every day. I would get physically sick if I did not have something in my body. In 2001, my mom and dad said they were going to separate, and that was right after my best friend had died in a car accident on his way to come get me. And I kind of lost it at that point, and you know, I kind of got the efforts. I didn't want to live. I had no desire to live. I wished that I would die, and I felt that way most of the time. And so I stayed hammered all the time. I mean, double time now. My mom institutionalized herself around that period of time, and she was certain that my dad was cheating on her with my best friend's mom. And I grew up with this guy. You know, we live across the street for most of my life. And so she went away, and it was really weird. It was just like, mom's going away. And I was like, what? You know, all drunk and high, what? And she went away, and then she came back, and no one talked to us about it. It was just like, okay, she's back. And I was like, what's going on? And then shortly after that, I came home from school, and it was like the one day I can't get one of my stoner friends to give me a ride home from school. And I'm on the bus, and there's my mom throwing all his clothes out in the middle of the yard. And apparently, she was not crazy. He was having an affair with my best friend's mom. So needless to say, that was the end of my dad being around in the household at all. He moved to Texas because that was convenient. And we know that your son's best friend died and his mother's been institutionalized and everything else that's going on with him. And he has a massive drinking and drug problem. But you go ahead and just move out of town. And that's what he did. I wound up in my first IOP when I was 17. And I didn't want to go. There's this thing that's possible in legal terms. Did you know that you might not be able to force your child to go into a treatment facility, but you can certainly turn them over to the state of Louisiana? I did not know that until I did. And they were like, hey, man, you got a problem. And I was like, nah, it's you guys. And I didn't say it like that. And they were like, oh, okay. They're like, all right, you're a little badass, huh? Well, why don't you go live on the street? And I was like, wait a minute, what? And they're like, there is alternatives for you to going to rehab. And, you know, I did the math. I was like, okay, I'm going to be homeless or turned over to the state, or I'm going to rehab. I don't sell that much weed. I'm going to rehab. So I went to rehab because I didn't want to be homeless. I mean, that's really why I went. The first thing these idiots do, they say, hey, when's the last time you drank or drugged? and you go, like a week ago. It's still wobbling at the front office, right? And I was like, look at these nosy people here. And I had to like sign this thing that said I agreed to abstain from alcohol. I was like, whatever. And then, you know, I'm sitting in my living room later that evening, and bugs and stuff start crawling all over the wall, and I feel violently ill. My mom's in the kitchen, you know, like cooking, and I'm sitting there, start shivering, and I realized later on, they asked me that to make sure I wouldn't get violently sick, which I did, but I didn't die. I just thought I had the flu. And I felt terrible for about a week. I threw up. I couldn't sleep. I had the shakes. I sweated. You won't want to know what else happened there, but it wasn't pretty. And a week into it, feeling better. 2 weeks into it, all right, now I'm in this program, and I can think somewhat. And I start to accidentally do something that I really regretted at that time, which was telling the truth. And I started to tell the truth in some of these outpatient, you know, group sessions, right? And they looked at me and said, "You're an alcoholic." you know, people in AA can't say you're an alcoholic, but a therapist or a counselor will tell you you're an alcoholic, my friend. And they're like, "You're an alcoholic." I was like, "No, I'm here for the other stuff, you know." They're like, "No, you're an alcoholic. You're going AA." So I'm 17. I'm going to IOP like 4 times a week, AA 3 times a week. I now have a psychiatrist and a psychologist. For you rookies, the psychologist you lie to, and the psychiatrist prescribes to you because you're lying. Okay? So put that in your pipe and smoke it. I could not drink at that time because when I drank, I got violently ill. That's the only reason I had any period of sobriety in that IOP. In that small window of time, it may have been 2 months that I actually was sober during that period, I started to contemplate killing myself. When I say I felt like dying, I meant like, yeah, every day I just didn't see the point of waking up, that kind of thing. I had a shotgun in my closet. I used to go hunting with my dad. And I used to think about that before going to IOP. Those are the kind of thoughts I started to get stone cold sober. And I'd go into meetings and people would say, "Well, just put the plug in the jug. Just keep coming back. Just don't drink." And I'm sitting there thinking, I want to kill myself if I don't drink. What are these people saying? I'm on all these meds. I don't care about all this stuff. They want me to be happy, joyous, and free. I go to meetings where they're all kumbaya. I want to flatten everyone's tires in there. You know, what is this? You know, and I was really mad that I had to go, honestly. I resented my mother for that. I graduated that IOP, and about a month later, I made the decision that I was going to drink again. And so let me just summarize what the first 3 chapters of the book says. It says that if I be an alcoholic, that I have a mental obsession. And I like the definition of obsession as a preoccupation. I am preoccupied with the sensation that alcohol produces. And my life now is consumed by that. In 3 years, I am now living in people's couches. I'm going to fail. I'm going to my high school. I'm not going to graduate. I'm going to get turned over to the state of Louisiana. If I'm sober long enough, I feel like trash. I don't understand that. But I think drinking is a good idea again. And anyone who's a real alcoholic and has had that experience and tried to quit and had people tell them, "Just stop. For the sake of us, just stop. We love you so much. Please stop." And none of that is enough for me to stop drinking. No threat, no promise, not being on the street, not having a car, not having a girlfriend, not having a mother, a father, not knowing where I'm going to eat is not going to keep me sober. Your stories don't keep me sober because my story doesn't keep me sober. I heard that before, and you know, I'm sort of a smart aleck. A little bit, a little sarcastic, but I hear people in the room say that. "I stay sober because I hear other people and it keeps me sober." And I'm like, you know, to a degree, I get like the common thing that we share here. But really, I'm crazy when it comes to the first drink. And I don't make that decision when I go back out and drink. That's not the train of thought. See, when I go out into the real world, and it's the real world when I'm in 12th grade, while everyone else is like going to college and stuff like that. Their parents are paying for them to go on a cruise to graduate, you know. Meanwhile, my mom's buying me a $10,000 big book. And I'm stealing urine from my sister during this period of time, you know. Having a nervous breakdown, you know, at school. Because why? Because it's the first day of class. And this is like me going back into school and I have a complete meltdown. Because I'm not drinking and I'm not drugging. And these people are talking about their lives afterwards. What are you talking about? I'm not going to live this till I see 21. You know, and that was my brain at that point. It talks about being this progression and how it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. It talks about, you know, the lack of power eventually that comes about. It talks about the complete lack of, like, what is that? The common sense, that kind of thing that comes into play. You know, the pains of yesterday or a month ago, whatever happens, these experiences I continue to have over and over and over again. And here's a good one for you. Tomorrow I'll quit. Tomorrow will be different. Tomorrow never comes, bro. I'm still the next day when it's tomorrow, I go, I haven't been to sleep yet. And it's tomorrow. It's not going to be today. I can tell you that much. And so, you know, I AA was a joke. You know, my experience with AA, people, you know, and I'll eventually get sober here in a second. People say, AA will ruin your drinking. Not so. I came to AA drunk as a skunk, and I had no idea I was going to AA. It was when I first got told I was an alcoholic. My mom decided that at 9 a.m. on a Saturday, she was just going to randomly wake me up. And like I would go to an AA meeting, not tell me anything. She was going to go to this Al-Anon meeting. Only problem is I got hammered the night before because I'm not on medication yet. And I had passed out and I drank this peach brandy. And to this day, I remember what this peach brandy was like because I have never had anything that classy again in my life. And most importantly, it wasn't mine. And so I drank that whole thing. I projectile vomited in someone's yard. I was in LSU at a frat party or something. I remember being in the back of a Jeep. I saw the sign for the exit to my house. When I came to, there was this vomit all in my hair. I had hair. I had lots of hair. And I had vomited everywhere. There was an empty bottle. It's reeked of vodka in there. My mom comes and wakes me up. And it's like, hey, get dressed. We're going to go. And I was like, oh, where? I don't smell breakfast. What's going on here? You know, what are you doing waking me up? And I remember getting in the shower and I was washing these chunks out of my hair. You know, I had fortunately not suffocated on my own vomit. And I was thinking, man, she's such a bee, man. She freaking woke me up on a Saturday, man. Like, who does that? That is so not cool. Meanwhile, remember, she's paying $10,000 for this program. And I told you, we're broke. And I don't ask any questions about how that's happening. But I remember going to that meeting, and she went into the Al-Anon meeting, and I went into the AA meeting. And, you know, I don't know anything about anonymity. And there's the weather guy from my TV station. And I just called him out, yo, weather guy. And I'm laughing. They got donuts. I start eating donuts. They sit down. I pass out. They wake me up for the Lord's Prayer. And no one is very fond of me being there, apparently. I don't know why. My mom comes out of the Al-Anon meeting. She said, how was the meeting? I said, it was great. And that's like my favorite AA story that I've had, you know. So I made that decision, like in this brain of mine, that I'm going to drink again. I drink again. She kicks me out. There's nothing really significant that happens. I'm selling weed out of Sonic. I'm hanging out with some people that'll pistol whip you when they tell you that you're, you know, going to get 1,000 pills of Xanax for $1,000. You get pistol whipped and he goes away and I sell for him. And that's the exchange here. It's kind of like my security. You know, without having to have a pistol, he'll shoot you or pistol whip you. So that was my thinking at that time. Well, he pistol whipped someone and put him in a coma. So he ended up going to the penitentiary. And so things weren't really looking up for me. You know, it was kind of, the cops were kind of watching out for me, going around my house, that kind of thing. And I got kicked out. So I'm weeded out of Sonic. I'm living on this guy's couch. And I thought to myself, this ain't it. So I go down to the recruiters. I told my dad, I said, Dad, I'm going to go join the Navy. He said, bull. I said, no, I'm serious. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't remember where he was, But wherever he was, he stopped what he was doing. He came and picked me up and brought me the recruiters that day. And we signed the paperwork. And of course, I'm intoxicated every time I go in there. And I go and talk to the recruiters, and they're like, you know you can't do that. When you come in here, you sign the dotted line. When you go away, that's illegal. You can no longer do the things that you're doing. Well, yeah. Needless to say, I showed up at MEPS. I was in the delayed entry program, gave me about 90 days from when I signed the dotted line until they owned my soul. And I got shipped off to Chicago. I showed up to MEPS at the Baton Rouge Cortana Mall, and I was still drunk. I got real drunk the night before. I know it's a shocker. And my mom wakes me up, and it's early, and her she's crying over me. I'm on the couch, you know, and her tears are waking me up. And I'm like, oh! I'm like, what's going on? She's like, my baby boy's leaving. And I look at her, I go, can we go to Waffle House by any chance? And so she takes me to Waffle House, eat an all-star special. This is going to be significant, I promise you. I get to the recruiter's office, and he says, all right, go ahead and piss in this cup. And I was like, I stopped smoking weed a long time ago. And he comes back, and he looks at me, just, you know, this disgust, this disdain. And he said, you're an idiot. And I said, what? I quit. I quit everything. He says, there's amphetamine in your urine right now. And I looked at him, and I legit said, I don't even remember doing that, man. And so they took me to a Walmart, and they said, hey, we heard that if you put a little bit of bleach in a gallon of water and drink that said water, that it'll clean out your system. I don't know if it worked. I passed. But I will tell you, it would almost kill you, because on that plane ride to Chicago, I didn't know God, but I met him there on that plane. So an all-star special, a fifth of vodka, and about a gallon of water with a little bleach in there. I'm feeling great, you know? And I made a few pacts with God that day that did not keep me sober. You can fill in the blanks about what happened afterwards. I got here to Norfolk, Virginia. My successful naval career was a total of 17 months. About 8 to 12 of that was in boot camp. Another 8 weeks was in the school to do my job. And another 30 days of that was for rehab. So, and all this time, you know, I'm under this delusion, you know, that this is normal. This is what normal people do. Normal people feel the same way that I do, right? They just feel like a fraud on the inside. They feel like every day the shoe's going to drop and they're going to know. I don't know who they are, but they're going to know. They're going to know who I am, and they're going to hate me. And what's crazy is that I showed up to here in Norfolk to the Enterprise, and these guys were like fighting over me because how I'm obviously not dumb, and I'm like following directions. I'm like, oh, that's easy, you know. I don't sell weed, but I can do this. You know, it's pretty easy. And I got a roof over my head and stuff. Cool. I was doing really well. You know that book, that part of the book where it talks about we are normal in a lot of ways, except when it comes to our drinking. I was an E2 filling an E4 billet. For anyone who doesn't understand that, I was doing a job that I was not qualified for, but I could do it. I was an E2 going for getting capped to E3. They're going to promote me just because. I was junior sailor of the quarter on the Enterprise when there's not anyone on there. There's about 3,000 people. And when the squadron is attached, there's about 5,000. My Lieutenant JG wanted me to go to officer candidate school. And then one day, this guy with an M16 comes to get me and says, you come with me. And I will tell you that the NCIS does not look like what it looks like on TV. They're all just snitches. They look like normal snitches. And so this guy tells me my life is over. I want to quit drinking, but of course I can't. And I'm going up to Captain's Mass, and in a short period of time, I get into this rehab. In between this time that I get busted and have to go on, restriction, and they inform me, yes, by the way, you've lost all of your benefits. You don't have any health benefits. You have no GI Bill. You're dead to us. We can't wait to get rid of you, you know, that kind of thing. Like, just get out of here as soon as possible, because now I'm just done. Like, I was in all fairness, I only got caught for being, I only pissed hot. They actually had me on. They actually thought I was selling cocaine on the boat. I was so mad about that, too. I was like, why would you think I would do that? Me? I'm only hanging with the guy that sells cocaine on the boat. I'm just his right-hand man. So I was dating a stripper, and things were going really well with she and I. I was living in a one-bedroom apartment with five other people who were unemployed. We got evicted from that place. How do you get evicted from a place you're not even on the lease for on, man? My car was repossessed. My father had disowned me, and I came up to the conclusion that I should just kill myself. And that was probably one of the clearest times that it happened for me. It wasn't like you could quit drinking. I was going to SARP. I was going to Navy rehab like in 2 days. And it was just like, no, we just need to bypass all that. It's not even worth it. You're a waste of space. This is just, it's so painful. And it's become so painful, drunk and sober, that I can't take it anymore. I woke up in a tub. I wrote a suicide note. I failed, obviously, but I was very pruney. I must have been in there for quite some time. There was a said suicide note on the counter of the bathroom counter. I took that note and I crumpled it up, but I did have a hot beer next to the tub where I just tried to kill myself. So I started to drink some more and I got into SARP. And that's what really happened. I mean, there was nothing like huge that happened besides me trying to kill myself. It was just this kind of, this is it. People think that dying is the bad thing. I was scared to live. I was terrified of living. That's where the point I got to. And I was the ripe age of 20 years old. And I knew in my mind, with my family and everything that's happened with them, this is it. This is the life I am doomed to repeat. And I knew no other way out. And I love how people talk about, man, I want to have this spiritual experience. Are you sure? Because enlightenment and suffering kind of go hand in hand. And I was having a spiritual experience in that tub, in the captain's mast. I was having a series of things that I could not otherwise explain. And there was some big plan or design underneath all this, because there is no other way that you would have got my attention. If all those things weren't present, I probably wouldn't be here. If one of those things had happened, I definitely wouldn't be here. But if just one of those was taken away in that time frame where I decided that I wanted to kill myself, I probably wouldn't be sober. That's just my experience. That's just what's happened to me over and over again. All the situations, all the women, the drugs, the drug dealers, the lies, the deceits, the IOPs, the running from cops, the hiding, everything. And it just kind of became crystal clear. That was my life. I came into an AA meeting at the SART program. I heard some guy, I'm in the church. He sounded like me at that time. And I said, man, that guy knows, he knows how I feel. He knows how I feel. I don't know what it is, but that guy, he described how I'm feeling. And I called that guy. I actually met him that day, and he said, call me as soon as you get out of SARP. And I called him every day that I was in SARP. And I called lots of people while I was in SARP. And I remember being at meetings. The SART bus used to take you to meetings. And at every meeting, I would talk to people. And there was this one guy, he was an older gentleman, and he said, Bobby, if I didn't know any better, I think you're going to stay sober. And I looked at him, and I did not know what he meant. Because I was just so desperate at that time. It was just like, I gotta get it. I got to get this thing. I don't know what it is yet. I don't even know what it is. I hear you guys talking about it. And I stayed here in Norfolk, Virginia. I really didn't have anywhere to go. I had everything I owned in a sea bag. My new girlfriend, not the stripper, let's be clear. My new girlfriend I met in rehab. So I moved right in with her, you know, it was a great idea. Oh man, I've had a lot of therapy. So I got here, I got sober, and I accidentally got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to accidentally get drunk all the time and just do these horrific things. Things that were just despicable, that I was ashamed of. Not the funny ha-ha, like, oh my God, if people found that out, I don't know what I would do. You know, those are the things that I lived with on a constant, daily basis. And I come into AA and you people are joking about it. What is going on here? You know, I don't know, but I'm going to stay. And I stuck with that sponsor. I started going through the steps. I got a key to the church. I didn't understand that. These people didn't obviously run a background check on me. But I was there to help set up the meeting and make the coffee. And I would like to tell you that, you know, first, my experience with getting in Alcoholics Anonymous was this tremendous catapult into sobriety. And it wasn't. I got better. But I didn't. There was a lot of growth that needed to be done. I got to the ninth step probably at 9 months sober. And at that point, I had no desire to drink. I remember being back home. I was making amends to my family. And I hear people talking about living amends. I'm not sure what that is. But I try to be a son today. And I had never done that. I will tell you that very quickly, as far as the steps were concerned, it was kind of laid out to me that a good friend of mine, my sponsor today, is Keith G. He told me at that time, first step, ABC, right? The first step in the ABs and Cs. Very easy. My life, I palace over alcohol, my life is unmanageable. Life sucks drunk and it sucks sober. Any more questions? Great, let's go into step two. Came to believe in a power greater than myself. My sponsor said, what do you know about that? I said, I was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. What do you think I know about that? You're going to burn in hell, and you're going to burn in hell, and we're all going to burn in hell. And he said, okay, well, that's your conception. If you'd like, you can come up with your own. And I thought this was like some sort of trick. He said, my God is kind, loving, understanding, forgiving, and patient. He said, you understand that? And I said, yeah. He said, why don't you borrow mine? I said, okay, that makes sense. He said, now, try acting that way, and you might get closer to God. What? See, when I got here, I knew strippers, money, and being a heathen. Let's just say that. I lacked social skills. And when he told me that, in reference to having some sort of relationship with a power greater than myself, I was like, oh, I can actually do business with that. And so we go along. He says, great. Now all you got to do is be willing to believe. Are you willing to believe? Yeah, okay. And then it says, made a decision to turn my will and my life over the care of God. And people say, I'm going to turn it over. What is it, your car battery? I don't understand that. It says in pages 60 to 62, you know, I am the director. And I remember reading that. I remember reading it for the first time. And if you're new, oh, you just wait. Spoiler alert. It's not just alcohol. And so it starts laying out this thing. It's laying out this guy who's an actor. And he tries to be the director. And he tries to get this right. He tries to get this right. He tries to, if you would just do this over here. I know it's not my job. And I know it's not my job here. I know it's not my job here. And I think in my life, if everyone just leave me alone, or she would be quiet, or she would shut her mouth and not tell her, you know, because I can have three girlfriends. What's wrong with that? And, you know, maybe I borrowed some money. You know, I had fully intended of giving it back at some point to someone else in the future, maybe. You know, there was like all kinds of things that started to come up for me when I read the 60 to 62. And I had this striking idea. It talks about this guy who is a taker. That's who he is. It says, in my best moments, am I not a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Am I self-seeking even when I'm kind? And what that means is my life was transactional for a very, very big portion. Some people have that in some areas of their life. It was like my entire life. And it was what I was going to get. And I wasn't always the guy that might drug you out of your car because your music annoyed me. It wasn't that I was always going to cheat on you because you made me mad. It was just buttering you up sometimes so that I could get my way down the road. See, I ain't no dummy. That's what I learned when I got sober. I think some of these things out. And I spent a lot of time doing that. And drinking just helps me get there sometimes. But I don't need to drink. What? You mean I can do all that stuff sober? Sure can. And I did. I looked very much the same for the first 90 days I was sober. You probably couldn't tell, other than I went to meetings. So I started in this process, and it changed immediately after I made that decision. I started doing this inventory, And with the inventory, in a nutshell, I think it is the most overrated thing in Alcoholics Anonymous is an inventory. People are like, you know, that fourth step, I got to do my inventory, or the columns, I got to do this. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, okay, close your eyes. What are the five worst things that you've ever done that no one knows? You've probably knocked out about 90% of your inventory. It only gets easier from there. And then the fifth step, you just tell someone. It's like, and guess what? They'd say, oh, me too. And then they say, oh, that wasn't so bad. I'm like, that's not so bad. I had 900 resentments. I'm 20. They're like, oh, whatever. You know, you're petty. Oh, okay, I'll take that. But what happened was, is there was this channel. I believe, for me, the fundamental idea of God is within me. And an inventory removes those things so that I can have access to that God. He didn't go anywhere. He never did, in my opinion. He was always there. And so the inventory opens me up. Six and seven is pretty much like, hey, how'd four and five go? Not so hot, huh? All right, let's ask God to do something about that. But not for the reason that you want. What do you mean? It's like, well, so I could better do your bidding. So that I can be an example. Take away these defects of character so they don't get in the way of me helping your children. This isn't like I'm getting the brand new car. I'm at step seven. I've been sober for a while and everything's going to go my way. It's like, no, you're going to act like a decent human being and act as if there is a God. 8 and 9 was pretty easy. My sponsor said, you want to know about your 8th step? I said, sure. Took my inventory and said, leave her alone. Pay him back. Go home. Make a face-to-face. Write a letter before you talk to that person. You know, it was pretty simple, you know? And it was like, oh. And he's like, okay, what do we do next? We do the 10th step. You don't stop. I didn't realize that. It says, in the 10th step, we commence this way of life. As we commence this way of life, or as we're cleaning up the past, we begin doing the 10th step. And when I first got sober, I stopped doing the 10th step. I had an affair when I was about 2 years sober. Let me tell you, that worked out great sober. You know, she was 44, I was 22, man. I went to so many meetings and ate out as much as I want to and flew all over the world. And then a couple years later, after I got done with all that, I was so more spiritually bankrupt. I was right back to where I was at when I first came here. And it was amazing. People were like, you're 5 years sober? I would be talking to people like, man, I don't know where I'm going to live. I don't have a job. He's like, I don't know, man. And I had the same experience that I had with me running the show, what it talks about in 60 to 62, of playing God, essentially, all over again. And I wish that was the last time. That was a really bad last time. I stayed sober, started working with Keith, went through the steps again, started sponsoring half of Norfolk. That's the joke. Someone told me one time I was one of the pillars of AA in Norfolk. I thought that was the funniest thing in the world. I went to meetings. I spoke everywhere. I went to detoxes. I drove people to detoxes. Someone didn't want to, you know, they had a wet one. And they'd say, call Bobby. He'll go get them. You know, and me and my goons would go somewhere. You know, we were at every hospital or detox we could go to. I was very active. I was trying to do the deal the best I could. However, I ignored some things that I did not tell you about. And is that I began to have some of the symptoms that people in my family were having or still have. And I was probably about 9 years sober. And Keith and I agreed to split ways amicably. In a way, I always joke. I wasn't angry at him. I just didn't talk to the SOB for 6 years. So we split ways. I got married and I got this great job. And now I don't have a sponsor. And I'm kind of mad. I'm really hurt, but I don't want to say that. And I don't deal with that. And I float to my next sponsor eventually. Never really process any of the information, never inventory any of that kind of stuff about what happened there and how I was disappointed and all this stuff, you know? And I got married, started having problems with my ex-wife, started yelling at her, started getting really weird, going to doctors, having panic attacks at work. You know, I didn't have those things before. And I was sober. I was super sober, man. And I remember being at work. I worked in a call center at Geico, and I just started crying. And I couldn't hear anything, and I couldn't talk. And my boss went, go to the hospital. And I went to the hospital. I went to the patient first, and, you know, that was like the start of a lot of different things. But I unfortunately hung out in AA and tried to solve a lot of things that AA could not solve. And I would like to tell you that that was a mistake. But I don't think I would be where I'm at in my life today if those things didn't happen. The short story is my ex-wife is my ex-wife, and she left, and I drove her crazy. We drove each other crazy, but you know, when I made that inventory, I saw that I drove her crazy. And I started growing weed before it was legal, and my ex-wife needed a green card and citizenship and was lawyers and all this stuff. And I just figured, you know, I'm making a lot of money, but I'll just do something illegal and make more. And I didn't tell nobody that, and I did it. And then, you know, a year later, I'm having that nervous breakdown after my ex-wife leaves, and I go home, hang out with my dad, and everyone's hanging out, and all of a sudden I just get high. Then I come home, and I'm like, well, that didn't happen. So, you know, I'm just going to keep going to AA. I got a therapist, and not going to tell her that I shouldn't do that, but I'm going to go to lots of more AA meetings, and I'm going to get swole up, and I'm going to work out. I'm going to start meditating. I'm going to get into therapy, and I did all those things, and many things in my life improved. But it did not fix the problem, and I had this lie, and I was spiritually sick, and I was unwell. In 2021, I'd been living in my house for about a year. It was during COVID. I didn't really come out of my house. I'm a little social extrovert butterfly, and I hardly bathed. I sometimes slept. I slept too long. I thought about killing myself almost every day. And I did that in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous because I couldn't ask for help. I became very prideful. I became very afraid that deep down inside I was a disappointment to you all, to everyone around me, to my family. And I had checked my life insurance policy, and it was like, million something. It was a good one from Geico. And I called HR because, you know, you got to tie these things up. When you're real depressed, though, you got to pick a window of what day you're going to be actually awake and cognizant and not high at the same time, you know, and talk to people and talk to them about your life insurance policy just out of the blue. And they said, yeah, Mr. Betancourt, everything's good. Your ex-wife, Marilee Betancourt, will get your policy. And I said, excuse me, I took her off my insurance. And they said, yeah, you took her off your insurance, but you didn't change your beneficiary. And so I thought to myself, my God, I can't let her have all that money. And who's going to take care of my dog? So I went to this PHP program in Virginia Beach. And it's basically, I call it a sad camp. You get to keep your shoestrings, but you're pretty close to, you know, going next door. And I went there for a few weeks, and it gave me things that helped me with the things that I was suffering from. And here we are today. You know, I started getting into therapy. I started doing things a little bit differently. I don't sponsor everyone. I sponsor who asked me for help. Shortly after I went to that program, I quit my job. So what the hell am I doing? I don't even like this. Yeah, I make a lot of money. It's not who I am. I regret that decision some days because I'm now a student. And ODU is just pumping me for money. But the life I have today is wonderful. It is very hard. A lot of the things that I'm dealing with currently in my life are like, how's the mortgage going to get paid? How are these things going to get paid? My relationship is very challenging. My family hasn't changed. They're still crazy at times. I'm very anxious. I used to think in AA, like, I'm afraid of a lot of things. And it's like, yeah, you should do your inventory. I'm not doubting that. But if you're me and you go to SAD camp, you should also take your medication. It's called an anxiety disorder, bro. You should go see someone about that. And so I take care of those things today. And AA is not my life. AA gave me a life. and it's allowed me to do the things that I think God would want me to do. It's turned me into a lot of different things as far as my practice is concerned. I'd love to sit here and talk to you more about it, but I believe that the whole foundation of everything I'm doing today is so that I can help the next alcoholic. And I did that a lot when I was in bad shape. And I'll close with this. I thought I was helping all those people back in that time, you know, sponsoring half of Norfolk. When the bottom fell out, all of those people were there to help me. And I thought all along I was helping them. And thank God I was plugged in AA, because I don't know if I would have made it out of that whole debacle. So thanks for letting me share.